Greetings, everyone. Thank you all for joining us on Thursday, January 19th, 2017. And this is Will Tuttle. And we are gathered here on our telephone conference call for the World Peace Diet Circle. This is the third Thursday of January. And it's just really an honor to be able to join with everybody. We have the World Peace Diet Circle as a forum for people who are already completed, going through the World Peace Diet Facilitator Training or Mastery Training Program, or people who are currently going through the training. So it's just World Peace Diet Facilitators or people in training or people who are members of the World Peace Diet Circle. And so it's kind of a special group we have together of people who are passionate about understanding ourselves more deeply, understanding our society and the cultural programming that is so devastating to animals and really to ourselves and to our environment, and to help share the vegan message of compassion and respect and kindness for all living beings. Also, it's a forum for us to ask questions, to share ideas and inspirations, and to connect with each other, and especially, of course, if you have any questions for me that have come up in the last month, or any comments, things you'd like to share about the subject of vegan living in our society today, which is, I think, probably extremely important for us to try to stay on top of things on one level and also stay underneath things as well. I'll let things get on top of us, maybe. But also to go deeply into our own intuitive wisdom without getting hopefully too sidetracked in some ways by the world affairs, which are going on right now. I think spreading and sharing and living the vegan message is really the ultimate antidote to the violence and abuse, not only that animals are experiencing in ecosystems, but also for social justice issues as well. So usually at the very beginning, I'd like to take just a few minutes and turn our attention within. And so I'd like to go ahead and do that now, invite everyone, wherever you happen to be. If it's easy for you to close your eyes, that's great. If not, just keep them open if you're driving or something. And the basic feeling that I have right now is a sense of gratitude for this beautiful earth and for all the beings here celebrating their lives as best they can. Very often, I think it feels to us anyway as a difficult realm to be embodied in, perhaps as human beings and perhaps also as other animals. It's difficult, but I think also we all have a feeling of the preciousness of our life and the opportunities that we have. So we give thanks for this precious opportunity we have to awaken more deeply and more authentically to the inner wisdom that is shining always in our hearts and minds, to help liberate not only ourselves from the delusions of misunderstanding, but help others also through love and through healing our own wounds, that we can be a force for kindness and mercy and tenderness in our troubled world today. And we give thanks for all the other people right now on planet Earth who are doing the best they can to help in whatever way they can be also instruments of peace and healing. We give thanks to all the animals of this Earth for showing us in so many ways the wisdom of living life with abandon, intelligence, and grace. And we give thanks to the children and to the elders, to all the other animal rights activists, of course, and people who have gone before us in the past, that we benefit by their light and people who are coming in the future. We give thanks knowing that we have really in many ways but a small time on the stage here for this lifetime, as the immortal bard said, and that we may use our time on this stage as a vehicle for sending forth loving kindness and, as much as we can, wisdom into all of our relations. Finally, we give thanks to ourselves for taking our own commitment to vegan living seriously enough to take time out of our busy schedules to be here on this call and to be part of this movement. And we give thanks that we are part of an awakening of consciousness of humanity on this earth at this time, so that we can emerge from the slumber of human ignorance and sense of separation and superiority to take our rightful place and fulfill our purpose on this earth, whatever that is. It is emerging. Okay, so thank you all again for joining us. And as I said earlier, if you are interested in asking a question or making a comment, you can do that anytime by pressing star 6 on your phone. I think that's really the sort of universal way to do it. Send me an email if that's not working, or if you have any other issues. I will kind of keep an eye on that from time to time. Just my name, Will Tuttle, at earthlink.net. I think that's probably a good idea. If you have access to email, you can do that. All right, so here we are, and there's a few things that are on my mind. Last time, which was in December, right? It was a little bit late. I think we did the 4th for some reason, because of our travels. But I talked pretty much the whole time, just sharing the adventures that we had in China, Taiwan, Vietnam, Singapore, and Hawaii. The overriding impressions from being in China. The main thing, really, if I think about it, and I think about our movement here in the West, which most of us are part of, the basic idea, really, that I feel is that it was very clear being over there that there's a sense of the deep rootedness of the vegan movement, especially in China, and also I think in Taiwan. In general, in Eastern Asia, it goes back many centuries as part of their respected traditions of Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism. And so the vegan movement is being pushed by and promoted by young people, like it always is everywhere, and also though by old people or elders or traditionalists who just love the traditions of their society and the sort of the good old days, that kind of thing. People who are the Buddhist, Taoist, Confucianist communities are all very much part of the have a feeling for the benefits of veganism, a sense of respect for nature, respect for life, sense of harmony with nature and so forth. These are really parts of the tradition and deeply embedded in the society. And so I think, in the West we do have a tradition going back to Pythagoras, but in many ways it feels, I think, to most people who are vegans in the West, like this is kind of a new thing. Whereas in Asia, the feeling I had, just a very visceral feeling, is that this is something that they understand at a deep level, and that they also understand that it's essentially a spiritual and ethical quest. That's very much part of it. Veganism is seen as something in the monastery, something that the monks and nuns do, something that's connected with meditation and with living a pure and clean life, something that has its ancient roots of wisdom. It just has that feeling with everybody. And eating meat and especially the large quantity, but certainly dairy. It's all part of the Western, imported kind of traditions. And so there's that. And then the other thing, of course, I just want to, again, reemphasize the power of the animal agriculture lobbies. In our culture, we're constantly fighting against, on some level, either directly or indirectly, the enormous power of the meat industry, the dairy industry, the egg industry, the fishing industry, as well as the chemical industries, which are huge and very powerful. They create the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and chemical fertilizers that are primarily used for animal agriculture. And then there's also the food industry is enormously powerful. The fast food industry, as a subset of that, is enormously powerful. And then on top of that, we have Big Medica and Big Pharma, which are hugely powerful industries that have enormous weight in our government. All these industries do. And so as vegan activists, we're, in a sense, up against this massive political and economic power. And on top of that, there's the financial industry, the banks and other financial conglomerates that are even in many ways more powerful than any corporations. They're extremely powerful. And there's also the defense industry, which makes billions of dollars on conflicts and war, which, of course, is also in many ways exacerbated by animal agriculture. And they know that food shortages and so forth lead to reliable profits for all these industries. And the banks in the background that are made the loans and have enormous political power as well. And so I think in China and also somewhat in Taiwan and these other countries, there's just less of that. There's just not this lobbying power of corporations and financial institutions to get their way and take over and run the government. And it was very refreshing, really, to be there and just feel that. When we were in Vietnam, it was very interesting because what we learned that dairy is being pushed really hard. People said that if you turn on television in Vietnam, all you get is ads for dairy. It's really being pushed hard. And the government is actually, I guess, being pressured to promote dairy also. The Chinese government, of course, is telling people to cut back on meat. It's bad for your health. It's bad for the environment. In Taiwan, the government is also having people cut back on meat. They don't have any animal agriculture to speak of at all in Taiwan. And so they have to import most of their stuff that they're eating. It's animal-based. And so there's this just very vital movement, yes, in Taiwan, especially. I think it's probably the most vegan-friendly country in the world, and also very organic-friendly. China was not organic-friendly. It was hard to get anything organic in China. But Taiwan, it's very big. And they have huge Buddhist temples with millions of people who are members, and they're all vegan, and they're promoting it, and people understand it, that it's important and helpful. And so there's just this kind of cultural momentum that's been rolling for quite a while, and it's getting stronger now with science showing the devastating effects of animal agriculture to our health and to our society and the earth. And so for me, it was just a sense of connecting with the cooperative spirit that I think is stronger over there. And, you know, I think, you know, like in the West, we have more of a competitive, individualistic, and separatistic way of relating to the world. Each one of us is an individual, separate, and we have to kind of make our own way. And so there's, I think this plays out in the vegan movement the way we see it in many ways. There is cooperation, of course, within our movement here, but there's also a lot of infighting. There's many organizations that are sort of competing for funding. They don't really work together much, and a lot of local grassroots groups are doing great work, but in many ways they're competing with the bigger groups, and very often there's infighting even at the grassroots level with people, and I'm sure there's some of that going on over there in Asia, but over and over again I saw just absolutely stunning levels of cooperation among the groups that were sponsoring the events that we were putting on. I mean, they were big events with hundreds of people. The media was done well. There was, you know, I was always given, you know, all kinds of just every need was taken care of. They were very conscious, and people were just, I could just see the way they worked together. They really worked together. We would have panels after every talk. Our local advocates would, you know, educators and entrepreneurs and restaurateurs and so forth would share, and it was just this feeling of respect and honor and cooperation and mutual aid and you know, the beautiful restaurants that are founded by people making investments as a community, a lot of community activist community bonding, I guess you'd say, and cooperation. So that's probably one of the biggest takeaways for me, and I think Madeline, I'm sure she felt the same way, was the one thing we could really learn, I guess, would be, if we could, here in the West, would be to work together with a kind of spirit of harmony and giving and sharing that was so evident over there, seemed to me, wherever we went. When we got into Singapore, it was a little bit less pronounced. It's a much more westernized. That was kind of like being, almost like being back in the West. There's still, you know, quite a bit of Asian influence, but it's much more of a westernized experience when we were there. So that's a little different. But Vietnam, Taiwan, China, we definitely, in all three of those, really were struck by those, by that quality. That doesn't mean, of course, I don't want to, you know, overly idealize, and I'm sure they have their issues, but in general, it was just great to see how people just networked and made things happen, and there was this freedom in many ways, I think, from a kind of competitive infighting that I think, you know, would really help our movement a lot if we could take this this step as in our movement. I think veganism is seen still in our society as something that we do in the outer, as an outer action. And it's just changing our behavior primarily. And over there, it's not like that. They understand it because it's part of their society, that it's definitely a spiritual, ethical, sort of transformational effort that's made. It's, you know, it's found in the monasteries and temples and meditation centers, the way of living, and so it's linked in people's minds with inner purification and inner transformation and spiritual transformation, also yearning and growth. And in the West, there's almost this, in a lot of vegans, there's almost this anti-spiritual, anti-religion idea, which I can understand, and certainly Western religions especially have been terrible for animals. And so I think, and you know, some of the Eastern ones have not been that great either, but overall, the Western religious traditions have been a lot worse. And so I think it's healthy to sort of, in a way, distance ourselves from some of that stuff, but underlying I think the vegan ethic is a profoundly spiritual sensitivity of the interconnectedness of all life and of questioning the official stories of materialism that just see beings as objects, as a thing. And I think in Asia there's a more of a resonance with that. And also there's a sense, you know, the religions over there for the most part are not theistic religions. I mean, Taoism and Buddhism, certainly Jainism, Confucianism, you know, none of these are non-theistic religions, all of them. There's no, really, I mean, for the most part, they're non-theistic. I mean, there's strains, I guess, where they have a devotional, they do have a devotional aspect, but they're very different. They're more like self-improvement courses or something like that, where, you know, just training the mind and entering inner stillness and deepening our questioning and living an ethical life and, you know, that kind of thing. It's much more that type of a way of looking at the world. In a religious way, it's very foreign to them, I think, these ways that some of the Western religions look at nature and look at the spiritual, so the spiritual path or the religious path. So I think going forward, I'm very inspired actually that in Eastern Asia there's so much progress being made, and I'm hoping that we in the West can learn from them, and I'm hoping, of course, that I'm sure there's things that they can learn from us. We're very effective at a lot of things technologically, and maybe this cross-fertilization is a good idea. But I really felt when I was there that I was being very much blessed by these people. They were showing me so much wisdom, and I wish I could somehow transmit it. Well, I'm going to be, I guess, doing some writing. I'm already doing some writing. I'll have an article out pretty soon about it. But anyway, so that's what I wanted to say about all that. And like I say, if anyone has a question or comment or anything about that or anything, please press *6. I'm not sure if I forgot to say that earlier, if I said it, but it was not when I was being able to be heard by everybody. And then the other thing that I really wanted to talk about, I'll go ahead and just jump into that since I don't see right now anyone pressing *6, is that to talk about antinatalism, which I think is a very interesting subject, probably. And as I said earlier, it's not one that I have strong feelings about, but I think maybe we can contemplate it a little bit together, and it's, because I think it is pretty big in a lot of vegan circles, the idea essentially that no one should have children, and that having children is sort of a selfish thing. It's just sort of wanting something for oneself, and we already have too many people on this planet as it is, and we shouldn't be bringing more people onto the planet. So I don't know what you all think about that. I think I have many thoughts, actually, and one of them, of course, is kind of interesting in terms of being vegans, because as vegans, the main thing we're doing, really, as vegans, is we're saying, I'm not going to buy meat, dairy products, and eggs. And so by doing that, we're saving animals. What are we saving animals? How are we saving animals by being vegan? Well, we're saving them by the fact that they're not going to be born, right? Because that's something that comes up quite a bit. People say, well, I'm eating meat and dairy, but at least, I'm giving an animal a life. At least they have a life. I mean, they're getting born because of me. That's not that bad. They get fed. They get, and they don't have to worry about anything. And then, they have one bad day and that's the end. But at least they're getting a life. You vegans, you're not even giving them a chance to live at all. And so it's very interesting because antinatalism is an ancient philosophical tradition. It goes back thousands of years. And you can see it very clearly. Excuse me. I used to teach philosophy, and the pre-Socratics and Sophocles himself. Some of the ancient. You see it in the ancient Greek tragedies. The Sophocles, I think it's in Oedipus. I can't remember which one. Anyway, the character says it would have been better if I had never been born. I wish. And then going back into Homer, we see that people saying that the best thing is not to be born at all. But if you are born, the best thing is to die young, so you can go back to go to Hades, and it's much better there than it is on the earth. The earth is basically a veil of tears. There's nothing here but suffering. The best thing is not to be born because it's just a lot of suffering, and the suffering is inescapable. And so the best thing is to not be born oneself, and it's also best not to bring anybody else into all the suffering that they're going to endure. And we see that actually in Buddhism. The Buddhist tradition, there's something called the 12 links. I won't go into all that. It's a whole lot of metaphysical stuff. But basically, the idea is, you all know the Four Noble Truths. The First Noble Truth is the truth of suffering, or better, it's dukkha, which means essentially unsatisfactoriness. And so the basic idea is that being alive or being aware, being alive, essentially, is we experience unsatisfactoriness. That's the root experience. But the thing is, Buddhism does go on and say that there's a cause for this. That's the second noble truth. The third noble truth is that there is the cessation of the suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and then there's a path to that. So even though in Buddhism there's generally this basic feeling that samsara or embodied existence is suffering, dukkha, there is the possibility of liberation or of enlightenment, of awakening. And the 12 links are basically the round of samsara, and the first link is getting born, basically, and with birth, and that leads to craving and to all these other things that lead to eventually to old age and death, and then to another birth, and so the round goes around and around. And so the idea is, how do we get out of this? So existence is seen as something to be escaped from, or something that's not the greatest thing. That's why monks and nuns don't have kids. That's one of the main reasons. But of course, in the Buddhist tradition, we have in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, especially, which is in Eastern Asia and China and Vietnam, Taiwan, Japan, and Korea, the householder tradition where people can still attain enlightenment but also have children. And so it's modulated quite a bit in the ancient tradition of Buddhism. And there is an underlying optimism or positivity that's very present in Buddhism also, that there's six realms that we're born into, six realms is three upper realms, three lower realms, and the human realm is the lowest of the three upper realms. There's the gods, there's the titans, and then there's the humans. And then there's the three lower realms, which are the hell and hungry ghosts and animals. But the basic idea is that being born as a human is the most auspicious, because that's the easiest for us to attain spiritual awakening from the human level. So whenever someone's born as a human, then that's considered a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's very rare. It's a very precious opportunity. And so we also have that thread in the Buddhist tradition as well. So antinatalism, has had many different faces, going all the way up through Schopenhauer and many other people talking about, she was influenced by Eastern religion in this direction, I think, to say that the best thing is not to have children. Some people arrive at this conclusion today, especially I think a lot of vegans do, because they're just looking out and seeing how devastating human beings are, and we're just destroying everything. So obviously, since we're destroying everything, it would be better if there were fewer of us, and it's so destructive to ecosystems and to each other, and that we're overcrowding the earth, basically. And so what do we, how do we respond to that? There are also, on the other hand, there are many vegans who have little babies, and these vegan babies are usually, if the people, if the parents are vegan and really solidly vegan, the babies are typically also raised the same way, and will probably, you never can guarantee anything, but typically they will end up vegan too, I would say. There's a lot of people who are sort of borderline vegan, vegetarian, and then their kids, who knows what they'll do, but in my experience, parents that are really solidly vegan, their kids end up in many ways being very similar as they grow up. So this is kind of a new thing, so we don't know how it's all going to play out. But the question also is, of course, what is the role of human beings on this planet, and how does that relate to our population? And I think it's very difficult to know what's actually true and what is just sort of official propaganda coming from sources that maybe are not that reliable as to the human population and its effects. It's clear to me that people eating animal foods are absolutely devastating our earth. So one of the things I talk about quite a bit is that if human beings disappeared from the earth, it would be just this wonderful thing, in a sense, from the point of view of the earth and all the other animals. It would be this wonderful celebration. And the whole earth would begin healing again. We'd have the everything, just, you know, the rainforest and the oceans and streams and lakes and climate and animals, and, you know, that we'd the zoos and rodeos and circuses and factory farms and slaughterhouses. I mean, can you imagine the celebration when all that's just gone, and no, and there's animals don't have to worry about humans imprisoning them and abusing them and enslaving them and hunting them and so forth. Sure, that's a beautiful, wonderful thought, you know, in one level. It's great. I mean, we just get rid of the humans and we solve all the problems here. There it is. So the problem is, it looks like to get rid of the humans, we're going to get rid of all the other animals too. You know, we have this whole nuclear saber rattling going on right now, which to me is just crazy with Russia. And nuclear exchange would not only wipe out humans, it would wipe out most of the other animals too. So usually when we get rid of the humans, we get rid of the other animals. And so it's not a celebration. It's an absolute devastation when we get rid of the humans, because the humans now have the capacity to destroy everything. Then there are people who say, well, there's just too many humans, right? And I'm not sure if that's true, actually. I definitely take that with a huge grain of salt. And because I think, you know, right now we know very clearly that we can feed everyone. But, you know, everyone that's here right now, we can easily feed. And if everyone was vegan. So to me, you know, we could have the great celebration. Instead of getting rid of all the humans, if everyone would go vegan, and we would stop, we would end all this factory farms and slaughterhouses and zoos and circuses and rodeos and medical testing facilities, and they would all empty, and they would all, and there would be no more hunting, and, you know, there would be a huge celebration with the humans here. And our environmental footprint as individuals would shrink drastically, especially in the West. I mean, we have this huge footprint. One person being born in the West is, you know, uses as much resources as probably 20 people in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. And so I think, you know, we have to really realize it's not so much the numbers of people, it's our footprint, it's our environmental toll that we take on the earth and on other living beings. So if we can, you know, reduce that, then perhaps I don't know if we know objectively what the proper number of people on this earth actually is. I'm kind of affected, I guess, by this video I used to show to my students back when I was teaching college in the 1980s, made by Peter Russell, who wrote a book called The Global Brain. And it was, very excellent video and book. And basically the video was a documentary film. And in there, toward the end, he's talking about what is the purpose of humanity on this earth. And his basic idea is that we should be the global brain, that we have the capacity to connect with each other. And what he said was, to me, I thought was interesting. He said, you know, when you look at the number of brain cells in a little infant, it's a limited amount of space within the skull of a little infant. And so as the little baby is growing, the brain cells start duplicating very quickly. At a certain point, they're just duplicating very, very quickly. And they duplicate very, very quickly up to the point where if you were a little brain cell in their brain, you'd probably be screaming, wait, stop, there's too many of us, we're getting crowded in here, I can't fit all in here. And that number is about 10 billion. But then when the number 10 billion is reached, then the natural wisdom of the little infant just kicks in, and the reproduction and duplication of these brain cells just stops, and that's the number. There it is. And then intelligence is created not by making more brain cells, but by having more connections between more brain cells. And the more intense the interconnectedness of all the brain cells, the more intelligence is actually created. And so his idea was that, you know, as human beings, you know, we're worried, and even back then, of course, people were worried. I mean, Malthus was worried about the population explosion, and we have Ehrlich's population bomb, and we've been worried about the human population for, you know, a few centuries being too, you know, too big. But he was saying that maybe the population, maybe it's similar, you know, I mean, like, who knows, but, you know, when we get to 10 billion, then it'll stop, you know, we'll stop, and then we'll just increase the interconnectedness of everybody, and that's how the intelligence will increase. But it's clear that we can definitely feed 10 billion people. We have about 7.4, I think, right now. And so from my point of view, if you look at, like, right now we're growing enough food to feed 9 or 10 billion people, and if people, and that's with eating a lot of meat and dairy, so we, you know, if we could feed 10 billion people on a much less land than we're using now, and we could still have a lot of lands for wildlife and habitat, and we could let the oceans heal. We wouldn't need to have any fish anymore. We could let the ecosystems and climate and everything heal, and we could have 10 billion people, and maybe that's the right number, but I don't know, of course, obviously, who knows, but whatever the number is, you know, I don't think we know what it is, but I do know, I have this feeling that there's an awful lot of people who have bought into this idea that we have to reduce the population, and I think that that's a dangerous thing, dangerous path to go now, because, so we're going to reduce the population, so how are we going to do that? Who's going to be killed? And this is a whole discussion that I don't know if we want to get into, but it's to me, it's one that's fraught with all kinds of problems. And so I think if people, from my point of view, really, first of all, Netflix says there are an awful lot of little babies and little kids who are orphans or who need loving homes. And so that, to me, would be one thing that would be a great thing to do, would be to, especially the vegans, maybe to adopt children. You know, that's one idea. Of course, there's, you know, problems with that, too. Especially in the United States, if you adopt a kid, then it's difficult. You know, they can take the kid away from you if you feed them a vegan diet because they think you're not nourishing them properly. So there's major issues with things like that. So that's why I think some people want to have their own kids, so they have more, hopefully some more say over how the child is raised. And one of the things I have noticed is, for example, we have Anna Ferguson, for example, just had a little baby boy, and she's a vegan in Cincinnati. And they've, from that, there's been a few other vegans in there that are all having babies. But out of that, they're creating this new vegan school. We heard about it, I think, last month, a vegan Montessori school, which is affecting, could affect hundreds of people in a positive way. They can be creating a new school that was never there before because we have vegan 7 kids. And so I think on that level, it could be a very healthy thing as well. Some people say that, that bringing a kid into the world now is not a good idea because the world is probably going to get worse and worse, and we're just bringing kids into a lot of suffering, and that could be true, but then other people would say, and I can see the truth of that also, that why not have a positive outlook that we can be successful in our efforts to veganize the earth and humanity, and create the foundation of a society of abundance and peace and freedom and joy and healing, and that out of the ashes of sort of present dysfunctionality can arise something beautiful that will be beautiful for whoever's around, the children of the future. And so from my point of view, I would not feel comfortable myself telling people whether they should or should not have children, because I think it's a very personal choice. And it's certainly fraught with many difficulties to actually know if it's if one's having children out of wisdom, because it's very easy to have kids. You know, I mean, it's very you have sex and then you have a kid, right? I mean, you know, so it doesn't take any particular ability or skill. I mean, people have kids all the time and they're not ready. You know, they're not trained. Their poor kids are going to be like their parents. You know, and which is not necessarily a good thing. So I can see why it's really good to wait and get to the point where one has developed sufficient internal maturity and spiritual maturity, psychological and emotional maturity, and so forth before having children. You know, that's certainly good. We don't have a society where that's encouraged particularly, except that it's so expensive to have children nowadays that most people do not want to have more than one or two because they're just so expensive. And so, you know, we have, an underlying, you know, in the vegan movement, an underlying sense that it would be better not to have kids because already we're stretching things to the limit. But on the other hand, I just think that if someone is a vegan and they have really meditated on this and they feel like it's the right thing for them to do, I certainly would not oppose them because it's a very profoundly hopeful act. And I don't mean hope in a sort of shallow way, but I mean if I have a kid, I'm going to really be working now super hard to make sure that he or she does have a world that's sustainable. I mean, now one should really be especially motivated. And I'm always kind of a little bit amazed, you know, how, you know, here, you know, so many of us who are vegan activists don't have any children, and we're out there, you know, working so hard so we have a future for our children. We don't even have any children. They're for other people's children. And other people, you know, who have all these children, you know, they don't seem to be all that worried about it, which to me seems utterly comprehensible. But I guess, you know, underlying everything really is that the basic idea that we have to question the official stories. And I would just, you know, always come back to that. Question the official stories about meat, dairy and eggs, about population, about who's running things, what's right, and so forth. And to do the best we can to connect with our intuition, you know, individually. I think it's very difficult for one person to say what someone else should do, you know, for one person to say how someone else should live their life. And the whole thing, I think, with veganism, we want to, you know, change other people. We want other people to go vegan. And one of the big keys, I think, to being an effective advocate is maturing beyond that sense that I've got to change other people more to a sense of I'm going to be just planting seeds. And coming out of the fullness of my own heart and my own experience of love and caring and awareness to just plant seeds as best I can and find a creative way to plant those seeds. And so I think if you see someone who has children, you think, they're jerks because they have children, maybe to just take a minute to feel into the deeper situation, because I don't think we really know, anyone knows what another person should or shouldn't do necessarily. We all have our own unique adventure of life, and in the bigger picture, I think it's hard to say really whether or not someone should or should not have children. And I'm certainly, I'm always open to anybody's take on these things, but I find that there's so many people who I deeply respect who have children and some who don't have children, and whether it's really the right thing or not at this point, to me, it's a very individual, intuitive kind of a thing. And I know, you know, for us, it was a choice that we consciously made not to have children. We just didn't think it would be a good thing because we wanted to be able to do other things, you know. But I can't say that that's right for someone else necessarily. So there is one person who has raised his or her hand. I'm going to go ahead and unmute here. Let's see. This is area code 317. Okay, you're unmuted.
Yes, this is Ann Mitchell, and I jumped on the call really late, but I just wanted to add a little piece of optimism. I got to see the documentary film tonight, Unlocking the Cage, about Stephen Weiss's work with the Non-Human Rights Project. And I
oh,
just,
really? Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's really good. It's won a number of awards, Sundance, and it's been across Europe and to Australia. But the basic idea for people who don't know is that he's been working for many years on animal rights law, but the last 7 or 8 years he has specifically been working toward and has thus far filed 3 writs of habeas corpus on behalf of incarcerated chimpanzees. And he's planning to file writs on behalf of elephants and I think porpoises, dolphins.
Dolphins, whales. Right.
But he's been turned down thus far, but he's actually gotten into court. And the last case for 2 chimpanzees that were having research done on them at Stony Brook in New York, the judge actually said she couldn't grant the writ for now, but she could see how this could happen. And the film is just, I thought it was really well done. And so if you get a chance to see it, I don't think it's available for downloading yet, but I think it will be soon. This was a screening at a theater. But it on the one hand, was incredibly sad to watch these animals and what humans have done to them.
Yeah.
But incredibly optimistic that there are people doing this. Oh, and in Argentina, on December 5th, there was a judge there that did grant a writ similar to that for an orangutan.
Yeah, I heard about that. Right.
Yeah. So I jumped on the call really late, and I heard, you know, the last 15 or 20 minutes of conversation, and it sounded kind of sad, so I decided that I would just share a little piece of optimism.
Right. Well, thanks, Dan. Yeah, that is, that we're definitely making some progress, for sure. And I think, I know Stephen has worked really, really hard, and the perseverance is what it takes in these cases to get... If we can just break that idea that animals are property and have them reclassified basically as sentient beings like us, you know, as persons, of course, that's what veganism is all about. But, yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. All right. Great. Yeah, I think I haven't seen that. I don't know if other people have seen the Unlocking the Cage, but... yeah, it's, in terms of animals and humans, you know, one of the things in terms of this antinatalism idea in veganism, that's one of the things I think, you know, like we as humans, you know, when we have these animals that we're owning, I mean, we determine whether they have babies or not, right? We say, okay, we breed them, or we refrain from breeding them, or we kill them, so they don't breed or whatever. I mean, we're always determining that. We never let them decide whether they want to have babies or not. It's all because they're our property. So I think we have to, as vegans, have to be very careful about telling other people, like, you can breed or not. I mean, that's what we're doing to animals. Anyway, yeah, but thanks. That was so interesting, and I really appreciate you bringing that up. Okay, we got a couple more people that raised their hands. This is, I think, Nancy. Are you there, Nancy?
Yes. Yes,
hi.
Can you guys hear me okay?
I hear you just great. Yes, thanks.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear of your stories out in China and how their whole philosophy and way of life is so in line with veganism, and they don't have all of these massive government and economical, you know, monsters. But
right, I know.
But despite that, veganism really is growing so much And I've been 2.5 years now, and even from during that time, I can see such a big difference.
Right.
So I can imagine for people like yourself that have been decades, that this must be a wild thing to finally see this happening, you know. And I wanted to, you mentioned something earlier. I'll try to be as quick as I can about some people say, you know, well, it's better to have some life. You know, we give them a life, and then, and there's so much that's so wrong with that entire logic. It's just, to me, one of those other baseless rationales that people have, and it's really all about them, you know, because they just want to eat the bodies, and they're making it,
right.
They're doing them a big favor. And I see those as two separate issues. Like, yes, life is precious, and it's wonderful to even have some. And if it's such a wonderful thing, why are you taking it away from them?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And the other thing is, it's like giving somebody a gift and then saying, well, I want it back now. You know, you had some, then I want the rest. I want it back now. It's like, what? You know, it'd be very confusing. You think, what kind of a friend is that? Somebody gives me a gift and now they want it back, you know? Or
yeah,
making somebody
like
dinner
like,
and then, yeah. And then,
right.
Okay, you had some, and I'm going to take the rest, you know.
Like, right. It's like being, like being what they used to call it, you know, an Indian giver. Remember that? An Indian giver, you give something, you take it back. That's from,
yeah.
It wasn't the Indians who were Indian givers, it was the whites, actually. They would,
right,
you know, they
right.
They would give the Indians some land, and I would take it back again. So the Indians said, oh, they're
Indian.
And
that's still happening, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
right.
That one is always kind of makes my skin crawl, but they come up with these incredible rationalizations, like they put 2 and 5 together and they want to come up with 20, and it just doesn't work like that. And that really, I see the roots of that in speciesism. You know, thinking
speciesism,
that we have to,
yeah.
to do that, because they would never do that to people, you know. It's the same thing with this super meat coming, you know, technology. I'm thinking, okay, well, if you're going to take all of the slaughter out of it, then would you do that to people? Why don't you eat people flesh then? <It's> like,
right.
I'm actually
yeah.
think super meat can be a great thing, at least for a while, because anything that's going to stop all the breeding of animals, and there's a lot of people that are just not going to stop eating animals, it's still, you know, it is a commodification, and it's still, you know, animal products are still bad for our body. And, you know, but the other thing I wanted to mention, there's some amazing vegan public advertising going on right now. And in Baltimore, there's going to be some up too, and there's these beautiful campaigns, and they're huge, and they are addressing the ethical issues of vegan and the equality among species. But the only problem I see is that without the health message, the ethical message will always end up falling short, because people mostly eat animals. I mean, half the reason at least is they think that they need these products. They think that they need it. So, and that's usually what the argument comes down to. You know, when people actually understand, well, they don't need it, that's kind of the first step in a way of being able to let go of them. If they know they don't need it, then it's like, hey, why am I doing this to these poor creatures if I don't really need to, you know? So I just wondered if you could share some thoughts about that.
Right. Okay, I will. I will. I'll share a few thoughts about that. Thanks so much, Nancy. That's really great to hear from you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, so Nancy is referring in that last part of her question or comment to something that I actually have listed in our resources for January. When you look at the resources for the World Peace Diet Circle, and I say here, I think the third and fourth ones down are Sandra Higgins in Ireland is behind the most viral billboard campaign. And Sandra Higgins is a World Peace Diet facilitator, and she's gone through our training. And she actually used to come on the call sometimes, but she lives in Ireland, so it would be like 2 o'clock in the morning. But she is a wonderful advocate, and she'll be speaking actually in Berkeley in March at the Conscious Eating Conference, where I will also be speaking, and that'll be, I think, March 11th. So she's on I think she's come to the States to give a few lectures. And she has her own small animal sanctuary in Ireland, where I visited, and she also set up 3 or 4 lectures for me when I was in Ireland just about a year ago, actually last February. year ago, and she has been really successful. She started with just a small billboard campaign in Ireland, and then it spread throughout, got much bigger. She got more funding to England, and then now it's going to be in the United States. And it addresses basically just the, as Nancy was saying, only the cruelty, the abuse of animals, and to see them as individuals. And so Sandra's idea is, you know, if she's going to make these billboards and spend a lot of money having them up for millions of people to see, she wants to make sure they're effective, and she wants them to basically, you know, she has all these animals. I mean, if you go to her house, it's she's got cows and pigs, and not many cows, pigs and sheep and goats and chickens and turkeys and about 100 animals that she takes care of with only one other guy. I mean, it's a lot of hard work just to take care of these animals. And but these animals have transformed her into quite a passionate animal rights activist. And she doesn't call them animals; she calls them people. These are people. They're just as much people as we are. It's just very wonderful to go there and talk to Sandra about the people, all the, you know, the geese people and the pig people and sheep people, and they have taught her a lot, she says, and they're the ones that are behind this ad campaign, and so she doesn't really want to give the health angle in these billboards. I'm very clear on that because I think she wants as effectively as possible to plant the seed that these are beings and that are harming them is the same as it would be, to, you know, harming a dog or a cat or even another human. It's just basically the same, that they have feelings like we do. They're individuals. They have personalities. And so that's what comes through in these billboard campaigns. And she's got them, you know, all sizes. She's got huge billboards. She's got electronic ones. She's got small ones, you know, in front of urinals and college dorms and, you know, just all over the place. And buses and everywhere. And I agree with you, what you're saying, because Nancy, because and that's why I really like, for example, Forks Over Knives and Plant Pure Nation and a number of the videos and books. There's so much coming out. Michael Greger's book, I think, is an excellent How Not to Die. All of this work that people are doing to lay a strong foundation that there are no nutrients in animal foods that we cannot get in plant-based foods. You know, there's no reason to kill an animal, to harm an animal. We have to, that has to be, very well, established in order for Sandra's, videos to have any real impact, I think, because, I mean, some people will do it. You know, I think, you know, I had the example of the farm. I had an example of 900 people that were all thriving on a plant-based diet when I went vegan. So I had that example. But I have met some people who said when they saw the suffering of the animals, they decided to go vegan. And they thought, even if I'm going to be sick and die and whatever, I'm going to do it anyway. You know, so there are rare people like that. But I think most people, like you say, they do feel that we've all been, you know, blasted with this program, that we're not going to be healthy if we somehow leave out animal protein, dairy products especially, for our teeth and bones, and meat for protein, eggs. People still think they, you know, are good and healthy because these industries are very effective in brainwashing people, essentially, and our culture has just, you know, been doing it for thousands of years, so it just comes through, you know, it's not so much brainwashing when it comes from your own parents, you know, and your friends and relatives and teachers and everybody. It's just people just saying, you know, that's just the conversations everywhere. Oh, I'm eating my protein, I'm getting my calcium, you know, so we're very much programmed, indoctrinated into this idea at a very deep level, and I think we need in a sense, billboards that work on every level to help educate, or not necessarily billboards, I'm using that in quotes, you know, whether it's videos or books or Facebook posts or whatever it is, to help people along the way. But I think what she's focusing on, and it's her thing to do, is to help people open their hearts to the experience that these beings are having to endure, And the fact that there are many vegans around, that provides the cognitive dissonance. People know that there are vegans. And so it's very important for us as vegans to not fall into the trap of being sickly vegans or being whatever, you know, whatever people think vegans are that's very negative, not be that. To be basically happy, healthy, creative, well-adjusted people. That and so the vegans are seen that way more and more, and it's happening. I mean, we're, you know, it's wonderful to have, you know, vegan bodybuilders and vegan athletes and vegan movie stars and vegan politicians, presidents. I mean, not politicians so much, but, you know, people. But I mean, I shouldn't say that. Politicians are also important. I think that, you know, people who are in the public eye that carry it well. I mean, Dennis Kucinich to me was a beautiful example. And but in general, I think. Your point is very important, and that's one of the reasons that I do think it's okay to mention the health aspect with certain people. I think ultimately, when people go vegan only for the health aspect, they don't necessarily. It's easy for them to go off being vegan again until we can somehow help them understand that it's. A life that's being taken, and you know, the suffering and abuse of these animals, then we have a motivation that's much deeper. And so she's focusing on that, and that's her piece of the puzzle. I think we all have our own unique piece of the puzzle to contribute, and to encourage people, you know, to contribute their piece, not say, well, you should do some other piece. You know, if I think that they should talk more about the health of the environment, then I can say, great, you're doing that. I'm going to do this. You know, that's great. And then do the part we can do that we think is important. And that's the most important thing, not to question other people too much if it's going along in the same in helping in that way, helping the vegan movement. It's their unique contribution to make. Hopefully that's clear. The other thing I'll just say, I'll just quickly respond, because when you said, you know, that people think that, well, I'm giving animals a life, you know, they have a life, and I hear this quite a bit too, probably a lot of you do too, that, well, you know, they're living and they're protected, you know, they're protected and they're fed, and if they were living in the wild, I mean, they'd be probably in fear all the time, and then they would be attacked and killed by a wolf or a lion, something like that, which would be a much more horrible way of dying. Than to be just stunned and killed, you know. So what we're doing is better. And, you know, on the surface, it kind of makes sense, right? I mean, that's the kind of weird thing about it. I mean, to the average person, not to us as vegans, but I mean, to the average person, it makes sense. It's like, yeah, I mean, you know, there they are, you know, Farmer Brown, you know, their old McDonald, whatever, they have their happy farm, and then at one point, yeah, you know, but we stun them, it's all, there's government inspectors there making sure everything's okay along the way. And so that's why I think it's obviously very important for us to not only know two things. One is to help people see the truth, that that's absolutely not what happens. These animals are born into extreme cruelty and violence and abuse and mutilation, which they endure their entire lives until they're horrifically and painfully killed. I mean, it's just terror and chronic terror and pain and acute terror and pain is what we're inflicting on them. And their lives may, in the case of some animals, mainly cows, if they're allowed to graze for a while, but now it's just less and less of that allowed. And then, of course, there's always the sword of the human right there hanging over them. So to me, the basic idea is that for people to have that kind of idea that this is you know, not too bad, is really a mentality that in many fundamental ways only slaves can have that mentality. I think people who are born into slavery that seems logical to them. But anyone who is free and who has a connection with their own source and their spirit would never be able to even entertain that thought, remotely entertain that thought, because it's so obviously a hideous. It's like saying that someone who's in prison has a good life, you know, because they're in prison. You know, I mean, that's not, the people don't, prison is a punishment. It's something that we don't want to have happen, right? We don't want to have our freedom taken away. And animals, just like us, probably maybe even more than us, they're much more connected to their true nature in many ways than we are through the indoctrination of our society. And so they're just living and celebrating their lives. I love, just today I was out watching birds deer living their lives, standing, looking around, eating, walking around, being together, being apart, flying, jumping, catching, And I think, we don't know what it's like to be in those beings and to be looking out of those eyes and to be experiencing our lives. But I think that it's probably, how can I say? I just think we should let them do that. I see a lot of celebration, a lot of feelings, we can't pretend that we know what they're going through. But to take that away from them, to steal their purposes and to steal their time and their babies and their lives and to steal everything from them, to me, belies a absolute enslavement of our own. We've been enslaved and we've lost our purposes, and that's the only way we can kind of blandly look over and say, oh, well, it's nice for them. That is such an absolute betrayal of our, not only of them, but of ourselves. It shows how far we've fallen, actually, as beings, to be so enslaved and blind that we could ever even think such thoughts and allow them to come through our lips. So I think as vegans, part of our job really is to shake people up a little bit, to help people realize and tell our own story that I'm so glad that I discovered that the only reason I had those kinds of thoughts was because I was participating in eating animal foods my entire life, and not only was that not in my best interest for my health, that's my best interest for my mind and spirit either, and I'm so delighted I've escaped from that cage, that prison. And just leave it, if we just plant that seed with respect and kindness and love in other people, we're not blaming them, we're not criticizing them, we're not saying they're stupid slave or anything, we're just saying, gosh, I'm so glad I got out of that imprisoning idea, and be happy, be respectful, and also the joy that comes from that. I think as vegans, it's very important for us to make a conscious effort on a daily basis, with first from the moment we wake up in the morning, to cultivate a sense of gratitude and a sense of the infinite possibilities of our life and of this day, to bring forth something that will be a blessing in the world, and that to build our life, to build our consciousness with that discipline. Because really, it's if we don't control our own mind, someone else will. And we have to be very careful. We're being bombarded constantly with a lot of messages that have, people work really hard to make the messages that are bombarding us be very effective. So that's why I think meditation is important, and understanding our mind and cultivating harmonious relationships, and eating clean, healthy vegan food, and exercising, and being strong within ourselves physically as well as psychologically is so essential. Because to be effective advocates, our intuition and our inner sense of being connected to our true nature, which is eternal, I think is essential. And it's something that's always available to us. We can take a moment and breathe and just feel that what I am is consciousness, and get out of the small channel of just my own little worries and things to realizing this is a precious moment right now. It's a real moment. Here I am. And notice what's around, and take a moment to appreciate nature. There's always nature somewhere, sky or a tree. And remember that we're part of something greater, a movement and a life purpose. And to build that within ourselves, that we, as we do that, we build a relationship with ourselves that's the foundation for a healthy relationship with other people as well. Anyway, I won't say any more, but thank you very much, Nancy, for those ideas. And there's one other person, Marlene. I'm going to unmute your phone. Hi, Marlene.
Hi, Will. Thank you.
Yeah. So, yes. It's good to hear from you. I know you're very active in promoting vegan living. What's new?
Well, tomorrow's show on Vegan Nation, on the radio show, is Robin Miller of the Humane Party. And I think it's really significant because she explains politics and how important it is for vegans to be involved. And on this special show, since it's Inauguration Day, I feature you and a whole lot of your music.
Really? So this is tomorrow at it's noon, I think, right? Eastern time? Or am I right about that? Can't remember.
It's 12:30 p.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, 12:30 p.m. And Robin Miller, what is that a woman, Robin?
She's the past CEO of the Humane Party. And
really?
She's the advisor to the current CEO. And as you know, they had their 2020 presidential candidate is Clifton Roberts, as he was for the 2016. But she explains the abolition amendment. The other woman on the call tonight was talking about the abolition and all the law and politics. So she explains the abolition amendment, which is what she signed. She's been a vegan for 27 years. And
awesome.
Yeah, and in addition to the abolition amendment, which will abolish all animal slavery and, of course, all the meat, dairy, and egg industries, and she also talks about the democracy amendment, which is to get rid of the electoral college so that each citizen has a vote, as well as the equal rights amendment, too. So she discusses quite a bit, but the primary focus is on animal rights. And, of course, your songs, including the turkey song, geese song, deer song, and lamb song. And
wow.
A lot can be free.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that. So that's WCUW.org, which anyone can hear from anywhere in the world at that site, WCUW.org. Thank you.
WCUW.org. Great. Thank you for the great work you're doing, Marlene. Oh, I love that. Thanks. Appreciate it. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. I think, you know, it's definitely veganism is a grassroots movement, but it's absolutely essential that we get involved politically also. And, just being able to reduce subsidies, for example, and as we expand the grassroots movement, as it becomes more expensive and actually reflect the true cost of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and then, of course, the fact that we're finding, which I think is a good thing, that there's just more products available for people making the transition. I just read an article today, just a little while ago, a few hours ago, it was actually in the New York Times about the Impossible Burger and how amazingly delicious it is, even to people who are eating, you know, regular meat eaters are saying, wow, that's really good. It's the new one, you know, that has the heme in it that makes it like blood and everything. But it's all plant-based, and so I think these angles are very important. The grassroots is the foundation, and political activism and everything in between. We all have a niche, I think, that we can focus on. I'd like to, if Lily is there, we only have a couple more minutes. It's about ready to we're about ready to end. It's 10:30, I guess, Eastern time, which is really getting late. So, Lily, you also had your hand up. I'm not sure if it was just...
Hi, Will. I'll be very brief. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Oh, yeah. You know, last week, Will Tuttle was on World Peace Diet Sunday, a group I founded over 3 years ago based on the World Peace Diet, and if anyone is interested in, I just listened to it again. If anyone wants to hear a comprehensive, wonderful talk that Will gave on his tour to Asia, to China and Vietnam and all those places, I'm going to give you a number to dial in, and you can just call it in on your phone, and you will be taken right into that. And it's just, I listened to it yesterday, and it's just marvelous, and it's just very, very uplifting, as Will always is. But you'll feel good. You'll feel good to be a vegan and know that in China, you know, things are really going on, as Will said. So let me go ahead and give you that number, 712-432-3903. I'm going to repeat that number, 712-432-3903. And the access code, once you get in, is 568-364-POUND. So it's 568-364-POUND. And you can do that anytime, and you can call in anytime, and you can also share it with anyone that, you know, would like to call in. It's a free call if you have long-distance service. And I just wanted to say, over the last 10 years, I've been studying about human slavery and human prisons since I became vegan because of the World Peace Diet, and there is absolutely nothing that has been invented for humans that can compare to today's modern factory farm. So I'm gonna say goodbye
right.
with that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks so much, Lily. Yeah, it's beautiful. Just wanted to say, I don't know if I'm the one who should say this, but Lily's just completed the third reading of the entire reading of the World Peace Diet on the Sunday night World Peace Diet Sunday, and it's going to start up again on April 23rd, as I understand it, and with the fourth reading of the World Peace Diet. So it's a wonderful group of activists or people who just want to read the World Peace Diet together and discuss it. But in the meantime, every Sunday evening, I should have a phone number. Is it the same number, Lily? Are you still there? Is it the same number they're going to be calling?
I'm still here. Yes, it's the same number. Marlene Nero, who you just heard with her wonderful Vegan Nation, and Joanna Blatt are going to be using a premise from your book called The Boomerang Effect, and they're going to have a discussion group based on that. And I'm going to come in and, you know, just listen in on that and contribute if there's anything that I need to say. But I'm taking a hiatus till April 23rd with World Peace Diet Sunday. And by the way, that is a great way to introduce people to the World Peace Diet, and people have become World Peace Diet facilitators just by coming on that call. So it's a great, great thing, and I'm looking forward to hearing Joanna and Marlene, and thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Lily. Yeah, so if you're interested, if you go to worldpeacediet.com and just click on upcoming events, you know, our schedule at the very top, we have World Peace Diet Sunday, and we have the phone number and the access codes, and it's every Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern time. It's a reading. It has been a reading of the World Peace Diet, but from now until April 23rd, it'll be Marlene and Joanna leading a discussion for those who are interested on the boomerang effect. As you sow, so shall you reap, and how interesting that is, the ways that what we do to animals we end up doing to each other. Sounds like a wonderful way to spend an hour. So I highly recommend, if anyone's interested in checking that out, that's a beautiful flowering of our community also. So, I think we're really at our a little bit past our stopping time, and I want to again thank all of you. Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, it's, you know, the live thing on the weekends with Marlene now is 3900, not 3903. So it's the same number, except it's 3900.
Sure, sure.
It's just right. That's the live one. Thanks.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Right, that's, yeah, thanks, Lily. Yeah, 3900, that's the number that's on the website. If you go to the website, it's the 3900. So I want to thank all of you for joining us, and I hope that you all had a chance to have some of your some of your questions answered and some of your answers questioned. But if you would like to have me go over anything next month, which will be, let's see, next World Peace Diet Circle, it's going to be in February, and it will be on February 16th, third Thursday. So if you'd like to send me an email, I'm happy to focus on something. And or you can always, of course, just bring your questions and concerns or thoughts to the call like we did this evening. So much love to you, to everyone. Thank you again for the many efforts that you're making to help embody and share the ideas, in the, not only in the World Peace Diet, but the vegan ideas and awareness of respect for all living beings. Well, I wish you a wonderful month in the days ahead, and whatever comes about, I know we have this inauguration, we have a lot of vitriol being spewed, so I think the best thing is to give our, as best we can, our love and awareness to all living beings, and know that it is a grassroots movement that will change the leaders, and that we can be part of that. And we can all contribute to that and to encourage each other in the work that we're all doing. So much love to you all. Thanks again, all of you, and I look forward to our next time. And I think we'll close maybe with the calf song. This is the calf song. If it comes up, let's see here. Here we go. Bless all beings.